Our next speaker started campaigning in the late 60s, I believe, and knows quite a lot of both sides of the argument. And she founded, she was one of the founders of the charity Release from London. This is, please welcome Caroline Coombs.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to talk for 20 minutes and then perhaps we'll have a little time for questions before lunch. Standing before an audience at a conference like this is for me somewhat surreal. Over the last 34 years since I founded Release in 1967, I have been campaigning to end the prohibition of cannabis. And today, my 55-year-old self aligns with the 21-year-old I was 35 years ago, and I seem to think, how can this be? Where am I? What's changed? How can I say anything new? I want to be witty, objective, cool, but despite knowledge gained by experience, that it does take many years of persistent campaigning to change bad law, which means that I should by now be less emotional and detached than I was when in 1966 the first person I knew was sent to prison for 2.5 years for being in possession of a few grains of cannabis. I am not. I feel sorely grieved that there is still the iniquity of prohibition, but more, I'm still proud to be militant and I'm still as angry as hell. If any of us have a sense of our human worth, then observing the way America and Britain enforced the world war on drugs should bring us all to a useful rage. The vile, corrupt world war on drugs is destroying millions of lives and tearing civil society apart. To characterize this war in any other way would be to lie. No amount of political cant from or sophistry from the likes of George Bush and Tony Blair can hide or change this simple fact. I intend today to get up close and personal with George Bush and Tony Blair. They're both hypocritical liars. In our new multicultural democracy, we have all the knowledge we need to spot a politician who lies. Not that we didn't know a liar in the 60s. It's just that today we are less bamboozled by those in power, less trusting in self-proclaimed great and good lords and ladies, and more able to challenge authority. Armed with the information and facts, we have actually come a long way since 1967 when Steve Abrams organized the famous Times advertisement. It was paid for by the Beatles and signed by famous people like David Dimbleby, David Hockney, and David Bailey. The advertisement stated that the law against marijuana is immoral in principle and unworkable in practice. It quoted Spinoza, who said, "All laws which can be violated without doing anyone an injury are to be laughed at." The advert appeared at a time when the temperance society was in full cry against alcohol. But by the 1960s, no Western government was about to ban alcohol. There were no votes in it. Certainly not after the American Prohibition disaster. Alcohol tax revenue was essential to the Treasury. In the 1960s, Palace Westminster bars, of which there are about 10, were full of politicians drinking day and night. Today, we know of politicians who are often drunk. And so what? Laws and regulations covering alcohol products and alcohol abuse are well policed. All of us are adequately socialized in the manner and ritual of safe alcohol abuse. With appropriate caution, the use of alcohol is considered a civilized personal choice. While drunk people are sometimes great company, amusing, and apparently capable of running a country, we do not trivialize the horror and distress of alcohol addiction. We know alcohol overdose can cause death, but we don't assume drinking will result in alcoholism. And even if we did, would we use progression as an excuse to send alcoholics to prison? No, we would not. we have empathic sympathy with alcoholics. We know that cannabis use is of itself not likely to lead to heroin addiction. We know that heroin overdose can kill. And today, when politicians use progression as an argument to justify their war on drugs, we know they are lying. We know they know the extent to which addiction is more or less pitifully self-destructive or dangerously antisocial depends not on the drug, whatever the drug, but on the economic circumstances and the character and the personality of the addict. Pre-1960s politicians like Thatcher and Reagan had the generation gap as a plausible excuse for their ignorance about cannabis and other drugs. But Blair and Bush have no excuse. They are our generation. They know about drugs from their own personal experience. Neither Bush nor Blair needs objective scientific research. Bush's drug-carousing youth is as typical as Blair's youthful job as a manager of a rock band. Even if Blair and Bush have not themselves had problems with drug and alcohol addiction, and even if they have not themselves had contact and used drugs or alcohol, they are surrounded by close friends and advisers who have. How about Alistair Campbell, Peter Mandelson, and Philip Gould for a start? They know personally about taking cannabis. And how about Lord Burt, and Lord Bragg, and Lord Putnam, and Lord Alley, and Lord Hollick, and Lady J, and Baroness et al. Bush and Blair, the leading law and order promoters of the Western world, apparently condone the execution of heroin addicts in China, while knowing that to treat alcoholism as a crime would be inhumane. Not even Bush and Blair would contemplate sending their alcoholic friends and colleagues to prison, let alone have them executed. Would they? Alcoholism is justly considered to be a socio-medical problem. Antisocial law-breaking behavior is where the law intervenes, whether or not the person has used alcohol. Without resorting to prohibition, the West knows how to reduce the harm, limit the damage, and prevent the crime caused by alcohol smuggling, illegal manufacture, and abuse. Even though we are today in the middle of a youth and alcohol teenagers' panic about alcohol abuse, are Tony Blair and Drax Draw going to announce an eye-catching, headline-grabbing new Labour, new prohibition on alcohol, even with their own children puking in gutters? Not likely. There are no votes in it. The sensible cry about alcohol is alcohol abuse, not alcohol use, is the problem. Alcohol education, education, education. The legal double standard between alcohol and cannabis is entirely corrupt, which is to say that Tony Blair and George W. Bush are themselves corrupt, as in morally spoiled, ethically unsound, misrepresenters of the truth. Tony Blair banned New Labour from any public discussion about drug laws because he himself needs to keep silent. For fear of being seen to lie, a whole generation of politicians affects to be dumb on drugs. If we had asked Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan whether they had taken drugs and they had answered no, we could have believed them. Mr. Blair, have you ever taken illegal recreational drugs? Mr. Bush, have you ever taken cannabis or cocaine? Blair and his duplicitous cronies are incensed when we ordinary people dare to ask persons of their standing so personal a question. But hey, boys, this is the new democracy. The personal is political. It is normal to see politicians at smart dinner parties, and I know, where joints are passed around with the port. People at these parties buy their drugs from dealers. Do they think we don't know? In our 20th century world of new morality, the secret personal behaviour of politicians can no longer be at odds with their public posturing. Standing up in public, like with pompous conceit, like the bibulous Lord Irving, and instructing us what noble, right honourable, law-abiding fellows they are, won't do. We know politicians are lying, and we watch aghast as they drag our democracy ever deeper into the mire of sleaze and corruption. And drugs are at the heart of it. To get elected today, every single politician in the West has had to lie about drugs. When politicians learn at the very early start of their career to lie with so important an issue about drugs, then it is easy to understand how they will lie about everything else. Party funding, personal finance, marriage, sexuality, the health service, pensions, insurance, immigration, they will lie about everything. Politicians so blatantly corrupt in their own lives can hardly expect better moral behaviour from anyone else. The police service, for instance. The police service knows that the prohibition of cannabis is inane. But why should the British and American police officers be any less venal and corrupt than our politicians? And how did we get into this mess in the first place? There are two key historical reasons to account for the legal difference between alcohol and cannabis. And firstly, there is the issue of race. Before the 1960s, except in the art avant-garde, the people who used cannabis were not white. They were mainly working class immigrants who, we cannot now deny, were habitually racially harassed and demonized from places like China, India, Africa and the Caribbean, where cannabis has been grown as part of culture and religion for centuries. Their drug of choice was characterized as exotically different from alcohol and stigmatized, like the users themselves, as harmful to the purity of white culture, smelly and disgusting. Cannabis was added to the Dangerous Drugs Act in 1925, but quite simply, we can say the race issue in relation to drugs can be put like this. White people produce and use alcohol in Europe, America, and Australia, which equals good and legal. Black people grow and use cannabis in India, Africa, and the Caribbean, bad and illegal. Wine producers beware, by the way. White wine producers beware. Murderous defoliant biochemicals, which America and Britain are dumping on peasant farmers in the name of the war on drugs, could actually be used on vineyards. After race, there is the issue of young people. This is in relation to the difference between, why there is this difference between alcohol and cannabis. Adults, especially adults in government, especially like Tony Blair, who advocates being tough on teenagers, are suspicious of young people at the best of times. But in the 1960s, a bold mass of youth confronted adults with a vengeance. Hippies associated alcohol with violence and aggression, as the drug of a nuclear bomb-obsessed, authoritarian, militarist establishment persecuting an imperialist, racist war in Vietnam. We embraced cannabis as an altogether more benign and social lubricant than alcohol, a natural herb connected spiritually to India, where our hero Gandhi led a model mass peaceful protest against British colonialism. Cannabis was emblematic of our enduring peace and love ideals. In the 1960s, British and American governments equated cannabis not only with so-called inferior black races, but also with an unruly generation of young people out to destroy their cozy old white world status quo. And if the good old white boys couldn't stop anti-war demonstrations, egalitarian demands for human rights, the sexually liberated, pleasure-seeking, fun-loving, multicultural, anti-capitalist, green revolution, then they could damn well ban the revolution's iconic drug. And while they were about it, they would bust the counterculture's icons, so into prison with Billie Holiday, Jimi Hendrix, the Beatles, Bob Marley, and the Rolling Stones. Prohibition of cannabis has nothing to do with any principled government concern for the health and welfare of society and young people. Prohibition of cannabis has everything to do with a white authoritarian political class determined to resist social change. Because of the 1960s racist reactionary morality, the war on drugs was and remains a civil war on multiculture and young people. Like his new friend George Bush, Tony Blair is a hard capitalist and a hypocritical religious moralist. Blair will preach morality at young people, but indulgently toady to immoral corporate billionaires. In due course, Tony Blair will allow pharmaceutical corporations to profit from medical cannabis, but he will punish with imprisonment young people who use cannabis for pleasure like he uses alcohol. Now, since prohibition of cannabis is not rational, but unprincipled and political, it is not going to be rational debate, but politics, especially principled street politics, which will end prohibition. If we don't want to be here in another 35 years' time, we must increase the decibel level of our political protest. Not that rational debate, if it can be heard, will do any harm. And I thought I'd tell you a little story now about rational debate. By 1969, the arrest and imprisonment of young people accused of violating the Dangerous Drugs Act of 1965 was one of Britain's most urgent social problems. After 2 years' work at Release with Rufus Harris, I wrote and published the Release Report on Drug Offenders and the Law, published by Sphere Books, 1969, in case you want to look it up in the library. The report was an analysis of the detailed records of our cases since 1967, with an emphasis on corrupt police procedure. Coincidentally, I thought, on the week of the report's publication, I was invited to Scotland Yard by Chief Superintendent Shirley Beck. This was routine. The law in relation to children was being changed, and since many teenagers, runaways, came to Release for help, it was often necessary for us at Release to liaise with Scotland Yard's A4 division. But while I was waiting for my appointment in the lobby, Chief Inspector Callagher of the drug squad apparently casually appeared. He asked me to accompany him to his office. He told me Shirley Beck was busy and that I should meet with him instead. I was escorted to a plush office in Scotland Yard, on the Scotland Yard's top floor, and there I was confronted by a phalanx of top brass, including Commissioner Sir John Waldron, Deputy Commissioner Robert Mark, and Birmingham's Sir Derek Capper. I was informed that Scotland Yard had read the Release report and that I must withdraw it immediately. Further, because the allegations about police procedure and corruption were entirely false, like Julia Gaitskill, the secretary of the Campaign Against Racial Discrimination, who had alleged the year before that the police were racist, I must make a public apology. I refused. I said that I had detailed evidence of every allegation published in the report and that they were actually lucky because the worst corruption that we had come across was not actually documented, although documented, was not actually in the report. And I said that I'd be willing to provide Scotland Yard Complaints Division with our evidence since they were obviously going to want to do something about it. When I got back to the office, I phoned the Home Office. I complained that since I had just given evidence to the Wharton Committee on Drug Dependence and I was about to give evidence to the Deeds Committee on the powers of arrest and search in relation to drug offences, what had happened amounted to intimidation of a government witness. I thought they would back off. The Release report was due on sale. But when I went to buy it, You guessed it, no shops had it in stock. We contacted our publisher, Anthony Cheatham, who is now chief executive of Orion Publishing, in case you need to know, it's a billion-dollar publishing corporation. Anthony Cheatham refused to take my calls. Eventually, we were tipped off by a sympathizer that the book had been remaindered for pulping. Rufus and I quickly raised the money, bought the whole print run, and sold the release report from the office. For the report to have been stopped before it even reached the bookshops means that the police and the government threatened the publisher with the official solicitor. Certainly until the 1990s, censorship of reasoned discussion about racism and drugs in the media was frequent. Today, so-called balanced debate on radio and TV is unreasoned and always promotes the government's war on drugs status quo. Incidentally, I concluded the 1969 release report by saying the law must be able to prevent the ill effects of drug misuse while individuals are allowed to do with themselves what they choose. Today, politicians state that to change the law on cannabis would be fiendishly difficult. This is a lie. If cannabis was classified in law like alcohol or nicotine, prohibition could end tomorrow. But Blair and Bush are in a state of pseudo-stupid denial, as if by clinging to the old white world dogma of cannabis prohibition, they can keep at bay the real liberal world, which they obviously find unbearable, disturbing, and threatening. The cost to us of their hubris is devastating. Whether we use cannabis or not, we should be as angry as hell. The war on drugs is paid for by our hard-earned taxes. At least $2 billion a year of UK taxes could be saved by ending prohibition. This saved tax could be spent, of course, on free education, a decent welfare system, generous health services, a health service which cares for addicts, and fair legal representation, respectful pensions, and efficient public transport. Instead, the war on drugs means that parents and schools cannot properly educate and socialize young people on the dangers of drug abuse. The war on drugs means that lack of education condemns some young people to die of drug misuse. The war on drugs means that drug addicts are unable to receive medical attention and the charity they need, and charity workers caring for the jobless and homeless young people and addicts are sent to prison. Bush and Blair are even now spending more of our taxes to build more prisons. Prisons in America are disease and drug-infested hell holes of rape, brutality, and torture. According to Lady Great and Good Runciman, we cannabis users should be happy her Police Foundation report has made this incoherent, unethical recommendation to government. That penalties for using cannabis should be reduced, while prison sentence should be increased for dealers, the dealers from whom we buy our drugs. Would Lady Runciman quaff her Chateau Lafite 1982 without a qualm, knowing that Lord Sainsbury was rotting in jail? Lady Runciman must come quickly to her senses and tell Jack Straw to stop demonizing dealers and license them. Personally, I intend to do all in my power to stop my organic, fair trading cannabis dealer to stay out of prison. The most serious aspect of the Anglo-American war on drugs is the extent to which it is destroying the cornerstone of our democracy, our justice system. With mafia in control of cannabis and billions of illegal dollars sloshing around, needing to be laundered and spent, not only are bankers, politicians, and the police being corrupted, but lawyers, barristers, and judges are being corrupted too. To fund this war on drugs, our civil liberties and democratic rights are being stolen from us. To save costs, declares our Lord Chief Justice, our right to trial is being demolished. Legal aid is decimated. Whether you use illegal drugs or not, this should concern you. Popular politicians on the left, like Ken Livingstone, who boasts of his huge alcohol consumption, and on the right, like Anne Widdecombe, who is partial to champagne at Conservative Party conferences, they support the war on drugs. Other politicians spread the myth that there are no votes in changing drug laws. All politicians fret about declining election turnouts. Apparently, people like us are too apathetic to vote. True, over the last 30 years, Westerners have grown increasingly contemptuous of incompetent, venal politicians. But it is not apathy which keeps us from voting. It is smouldering rage. Only when politicians start making ethical laws which match their own personal behaviour, will they be rewarded with our interest and our votes. Meanwhile, we eye politicians who control drug laws like Bush and Blair. We observe that they are bad people. We are right not to vote for bad people. Go to the ballot box, cherish your hard-won right to vote, and as part of our continued political street struggle to end prohibition, do what the Legalized Cannabis Alliance suggests, spoil your ballot by writing across it, "Legalize Cannabis."